Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Answers from the Lab, where we share Mayo Clinic knowledge and advancements on the state of testing and science from laboratory leaders and the people who are making it happen behind the scenes. I'm Dr. Bobby Pritt, Chair of the Division of Clinical Microbiology at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And with me today is Dr. Bill Maurice, the President and CEO of Mayo Clinic Laboratories.
Hi, Bill. Welcome back.
Hi, Bobby. It's good to see you.
Yeah, so you're on the road, I'm on the road, and we have big news for everyone. So we thought it was so important we needed to meet in this special session to talk about the FDA ruling for lab-developed tests.
Yeah, for any Monty Python fans out there, if you've ever seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, there's a scene where the two guards are eating an apple. They see the knight running across the field, and each frame he's far away, far away. And then it's the frame, and he's stabbing them both in the stomach and going through the gate. And it kind of feels like that with the FDA. It's been out there. And all of a sudden, Monday, it came up and grabbed us.
I know. And grabbed us. And we've been talking about this for a while. So the final ruling was released. It's fairly unchanged from the original rule, but there are some important caveats. But essentially still, FDA is going to regulate laboratory developed tests as medical devices with a 4-year implementation period. And the implementation milestones are almost the same. It's a broad scope, large role, but there's some very important exceptions that we should discuss.
Absolutely.
Before we get into those, any other comments, Bill, though, from your standpoint of just that this is finally live?
One thing for sure is it removes a lot of uncertainty, right?
Right.
We were kind of wondering whether this was going to happen or not. If it was, what did it look like? I think you talking through the important exceptions, the first thing I would say is it's very similar to the proposed rule, but there are some important caveats to your point. So maybe we should walk through those first.
Yeah, and we should probably also say that this is a very long document and it's a complex legal document. So everyone should go and read it for some good bedtime reading. Talk to some people that have really read it and understand it, because there's a good amount of information there to digest.
Yeah, and very important point. And when you say read it and understand it, this is something I've learned because of my having to be in DC for ACLIN for advocacy issues and interacting with the agencies. I mean, it's primarily lawyers. We think of FDA and we think of tests, you think more of science, but actually in medicine, but these documents are often written by lawyers. That's why there's different codes. They speak in codes. There's a whole lingo. The point being that if you have like a risk management office at the hospital or healthcare system you work in or lab, I mean, actually getting some kind of someone with expertise, a lawyer with expertise in reading legal documents becomes really important, because the way things are even phrased can have really significant ramifications.
Yeah, and we'll try to highlight there are some areas with uncertainty. We don't have all the answers, but we can cover some of the important points. I'll start with the first is that this is 5 stages over 4 years. And starting in stage one, which is 1 year after the publication of the rule, and that is registered as May 6, 2025, labs have to be in compliance with medical device reporting. Then stage two, there's a registration and listing stage. It goes through stage three, stage four, stage five. Stages four and five are when the laboratories need to start submitting PMA and 510K applications. The PMA is for the high risk. The 510K would be for the low and moderate risks. But I think it's important to note that as early as by year one, after the publication of the final rule, there are things that laboratories will have to do.
Yep, absolutely. We went through this ourselves, Bobby, as pathologists here at Mayo, when we made the commitment, as we'll talk to later on, to make sure all of our tests went through New York State.
Yeah.
Just getting the consistent documentation from different labs, getting access, because you have to have your test development data. That was a lot of work. And this is going to be another level of magnitude beyond that. I think just the administrative work of getting the paperwork of what you have already done is something you should start thinking about right now. And I would bet if you have a transfusion medicine, a blood donor center that works with FDA in your department or in your institution, they're a great group to talk with, because I knew a lot about FDA because we have transfusion medicine with a blood donor center in our department. So we get inspected by FDA, and it's just much different. And now that lab developed tests are regulated by them, they can actually inspect you as well. So they could come and check your documentation and things.
And there's going to be a lot left to the discretion of FDA, which is actually good in some ways, because there are some areas where FDA is going to continue to exercise enforcement discretion. So first major area for this is what we've been calling grandfathering for existing tests. So the FDA will exercise enforcement discretion, i.e. grandfather, all LDTs that are on the market, and I believe it's that they've been implemented prior to the issuance of the final rule, which we think is probably May 6th, but we need to confirm that for sure. That's actually, I think, a win-win for laboratories and for the FDA and for patients and quality of care. The FDA still has the ability to use their discretion to enforce tests. So if there is a test that they're concerned about that's causing patient harm, they can still go after that laboratory, but they are not requiring all the tests that are used as in the laboratories as lab developed tests to be submitted through this new process, which would have been a tremendous, really untenable burden for our laboratories.
Agreed. But again, you still have to have the documentation.
Yes, you still have to register yourself and submit all of them. But you don't have to submit them all for a 510K,
Exactly. It was a major ask that they included in the final rule.
Yeah, so that was, I think, a win for everyone involved. As we said, laboratories will still need to meet the stage one and stage two requirements. And going forward now, anything that's been, quote, grandfathered in is going to be limited in what you can do. If you modify that assay, now all of a sudden it's no longer under that grandfathering. It might need to be submitted. So that's something to keep in mind. Hopefully everyone has their assays in a good spot, but you know, things change. Instruments become discontinued. You have to start a new instrument or a chemistry, accept an additional source. Now you've modified it past what was in that grandfathering clause and you may need to submit it to the FDA.
Yep. The other thing that came up is, because I'm actually here at the Executive War College and I was leading a panel with Tim Stenzel, who was formerly at the FDA on it. When you're thinking about as a manufacturer, that means you're responsible for your for the materials that you're using, right? And that I think we might see that, like, you might need to have more documentation if you're using RUOs, for instance. Yes. You know, that was a topic that you were actually going to have to maintain a validation record for lots. I mean, just little things like that, understanding what the expectations are is just different.
I agree. And the RUOs, research use only, that is such a widely used category in the laboratory world. And sometimes it's probably just for the ease of the manufacturer, because we have reagents like PCR grade water that's listed as an RUO. And that probably could just be like a class one device or whatever the appropriate classification would be. So this may actually cause some manufacturers to start registering their products, which would be good. But it will mean more documentation, and people will probably be surprised. A lot of components of lab-developed tests are considered RUO, and it says research use only, and yet we know we're taking responsibility for the validation and the quality systems if we're using these products in our final lab-developed test.
Yep. But yeah, another important exception in there is the New York State. If you've gone through the New York State CLEP program, in my reading of it was that essentially you're considered compliant with FDA.
Laboratories that are already going through that process, that is a major win for them. The large reference laboratories that test patient specimens from New York State are probably already have gone through this process. All the laboratories in New York State probably have gone through this process if they're using lab-developed tests. What we don't know is if New York State is going to be willing to open up their review process for other laboratories that don't fill in those requirements, but I guess that's still to be determined.
That's right. Yeah, we'll see. And it's also to be determined because we made the decision, it might have been when I was Hemopath Division Chair, so at least like in around 2009, I want to say, to put...
It was 2009. I remember because I started as a new consultant at Mayo, and my very first year, I had to revalidate 23 real-time PCR assays to be compliant with New York State. So it's doable. New York State is reasonable. You can work with them. They give great instructions, but it is an additional layer of documentation and likely some additional studies that labs will need to do to go through that New York State process.
Yeah, but having us both having lived through it, there was the same the issues we just talked about. So all of our states go through New York State approval, which is nice. I mean, it actually for the lab, it does give you, especially if you're in a big lab, big academic medical center like Mayo, you get a much better layer of consistency or level of consistency, I should say. But when we did it, I think we all were pretty surprised at how many differences there were between labs in terms of how they made. Mm-hmm. So it's important. And it is a scientific review. There are PhDs there. So they will ask sometimes for more data or clarification or access to raw data. So it's things to really, and you can then also get inspected by New York State, which we also do. It's very doable. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is work.
It is, yes. So we'll see how that goes. Another, I think, very important positive, I would say, from this ruling is that laboratories that are integrated into a healthcare system also may fall under the enforcement discretion for their LDTs. So FDA will exercise enforcement discretion for LDTs that are performed by a laboratory integrated into a healthcare system that specifically address an unmet and performed on patients receiving care within that same healthcare system. And when they say unmet need, that means also, though, that there are no FDA cleared or authorized tests that are available to meet those patient needs, so that laboratory in that healthcare system had to create a lab-developed test. So if there were to become an FDA-approved or cleared test in the future, then all of a sudden that LDT is no longer valid under this exception.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting one as well. Mm-hmm. It essentially, to me, is like, if you're not doing outreach, meaning you're not offering your test from your lab to patients outside of your healthcare system, you're fine. I think it would be very challenging for them to justify, you know, unmet. It's a good reason to look at FDA approved tests. But to me, the big thing is for labs that are doing a lot of outreach, that it's probably going to have to don't want to pay attention to that.
I agree. And I think a good example of this would be, let's say our laboratory in Minnesota happens to be highly endemic for babesiosis, a tick-borne disease. There's no real-time PCR assay for babesiosis. So healthcare systems in Minnesota laboratories have created lab-developed real-time PCR assays for babesiosis. Now, maybe in the future, we will have commercially available FDA-authorized lab assays, but right now, there are none. So I think that's positive. And I also want to note that this gets back a little bit to the original discussions of making exceptions for academic medical centers, AMCs. And, you know, your work with ACLA, my work with CAP, we really push to say, it's not just academic medical centers that are working within a healthcare system that are producing high quality tests. There are, you know, multiple laboratories that are similarly integrated within healthcare systems. So it's nice to see that this has been broadened a little bit to talk about the same healthcare system and not just limiting it to academic medical centers.
Yeah, I agree. So let's touch on this in the last few minutes, because so that's what's in the final rule, because right now it's, quotes, on display, and it has to be on display, mm-hmm. I think, for 60 days. So there's a whole bunch of procedural things. We might have a 60-day window. And if you got a test out there, you want to get it out, you might. So, mm-hmm. But and more seriously, though, it's kind of interesting. I mentioned I'm at the Executive War College, so I'm hearing from a lot of different people, different segments of the diagnostic testing industry, about their reaction to it. And I'm wondering, you're probably hearing the same.
I am, Bill. And I think there's still some unanswered questions. For example, there's also perhaps other exceptions for tests that were developed before 1976, manual LDTs. But does that mean if you have an LDT, like an immunohistochemical stain, but then you automate it, does that immediately kick it out of this exception? So I think that there's going to be more reflection. People are going to be reading all those hundreds of pages. The lawyers are going to get involved in helping us interpret them. And we may have the opportunity to talk to the FDA to get some clarification.
Yeah, for sure. You know, if you take a step back from the good news perspective, is that this seems to be much more livable than the proposed rule, because the proposed rule had none of these exceptions. It just spoke to, we made grandfather. So I think we were all pleasantly surprised that, wow, this is probably something labs can live with, not that we mm-hmm. would necessarily like it. The flip side is, if you're going to take the pessimistic view, you're going to view this as the camel's nose in the tent, as they say, because if we acknowledge that tests are medical devices mm-hmm. and that FDA has had this authority all along, what's to stop them from saying, we're going to end enforcement discretion now on this? Because they're basically saying, we can do any of these things that we have in here. We can ignore these things. We're just, right now, this is, we're not going to apply the rule. So I think that's going to be a major concern from the laboratory perspective. And as a point was made by one of the panelists yesterday, look, it's been a challenging time financially for labs. This is going to add a lot of administrative work. who's going to do the work, those sorts of things. The other thing I'm hearing is you're probably going to see other responses outside the lab that may help or hinder us. So on the one hand, you'll probably see consulting firms cropping up, coming in to help you get your tests ready. You know, you'll probably see software systems that are created. I know we looked for a software system that could really manage all the data for us that would be required, that we needed one that was actually FDA compliant because we're using it for transfusion medicine. So those exist, but they'll probably see more of those kind of pop up that you can just then populate, because the same information FDA will want will be the same information Palmetto would want for Z codes and other things. So you'll want to think, so there'll be, you'll see a whole proliferation. And then last but not least, you mentioned it, is the diagnostic industry manufacturers, or what are they going to do? Are they going to start putting more of their materials through FDA? Are they going to be more open to helping labs validate tests? There's a lot of different things that are out there, but I think the major one would be, we can live with it, but should we live with it?
Yeah, and there may be further movement with the Congress in the future. Valid Act is not completely dead. It could be revived. It could be brought up. And it's not exclusive with what FDA is doing. So we'll have to keep an eye on that as well.
We've discussed that here. I've had the opportunity to meet with FDA high-level people on a few occasions. And it was always that they would have preferred a legislative solution and were disappointed that it didn't pass. So the other piece of this, it would be, if legislation passed, it would still be good for us that codified these things. Because once it's, if we had a lab-specific rule that said these are how labs are regulated, then it takes out the whole kind of sort of Damocles of enforcement discretion, because it would say, no, these are the things that you can and can't do, FDA, in regulating laboratory developed tests. I agree completely. And I do think that probably behind the scenes, you're from your leadership in CAP and probably from me in ACLA, it'll be interesting to see if all of a sudden now that FDA is trying to get people back to the table now, saying we're not trying to kill the labs, but we feel like they need to be regulated. Are you open to working with us to get something passed legislatively?
Yeah, so we will keep an eye on that. We will keep everyone updated as always. And I also learned something new from you, Bill. I'd never known the saying of the camel's nose in the tent. I like that. I think I'm going to use that.
I got that. That was actually, I think, from Professor Tribe, a lawyer in Harvard, who actually studied this issue on behalf of ACLA like 10 years ago. And he used that when he was talking about the camel. That's exactly, the FDA camel's getting in nose. The labs was the camel's nose in the tent. And I liked it too. So the other thing he said that I'll never forget is, those who use a crystal ball to predict the future should be prepared to eat broken glass. And those are the two things. And, you know, that's why they're lawyers. They're good with the phrases, I guess. So
I guess so. Well, thanks for going over this with us, Bill. And we
likewise.
Will keep updating everyone as we find out more information as it unrolls over the coming days and weeks.
I look forward to it.
All right. Take care, Bill.
Safe travels.
You too.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Answers from the Lab. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast and don't forget to tune in every Thursday and every other Tuesday.